Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbisn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. This is your regular Wednesday night host, Kim Justice, with Recovery Now. And at this special time of the month, the last Wednesday of each month, I play our generic intro because it's our Simon Says night. And Simon Lewis is my co-host. I see we've got a caller, and don't hang up, Michael. I will bring you on and let you make your announcement right after I open here. Anyway, welcome, everybody. So happy that you're here tonight. Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We Recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. If you want to know more about me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. And my co-host, who I'm going to bring on in a moment, Simon Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. If you'd like to know more about Simon, you can check out his websites, riseandshinethebook.com and simonlewis.us. As for the intro song that you heard, our sponsor, TBI Radio, part of that, the person responsible has also been a musician. And that song, if you're interested in supporting us — we don't come out and ask for donations, we haven't in 13 years, but unless, if you would like to make a tax-deductible donation, if you like what you hear, feel free to get a hold of Craig or me, and we can help you with that. Otherwise, what I was going to say about the music, and we'll be playing a little bit more later, is if you check out their website, therinsane.com, you'll find a lot of music. And not all that long ago, Craig and his band made a 3-album set that was farewell tour. There were probably another 5 albums before that. So the band, by a couple different names and a couple incarnations, same people, some politics involved, have made all of these albums, and that music is available for purchase. So I encourage you to check it out. And if there's a song or 5 that you like, consider buying them for your playlist. And with that, I'm going to bring on Simon Lewis, and then I see that we have an announcement from Michael. I'll bring on Simon first and wish him a good evening, and then we'll let Michael on to talk about a big announcement. I know he was waiting on and probably has the answer. Simon, welcome to the show tonight. You're on the mend or working on it?
It's a work in progress, Kim. It's been going on for about 28 years now. So, yes, thank you. And it's really nice to be back on the air with you and to talk about this question of blind sight and stress. Somehow they go hand in hand or hand in brain. So, yes, I don't want to take away from Michael and making his announcement. So I will let you take back the ball. But really, it's lovely to be on the air with you. And I think we've got lots of interesting things to explore tonight with the community.
Me too. And Michael always has to get off to bed, but he's been working on a most impressive project and was waiting for an answer on something. So I'm going to let Michael on for a moment and let him make his announcement, because you might want to change your travel plans, some of you listeners out there. Michael, how's it going?
Hello, Kim. Can you hear
Hello.
Me?
Hello. I can Hello. Hear you fine.
Yes, I just wanted to announce that Pinellas County, Florida, we just laid our fifth Mobi mat, which is a mat that goes from the cement all the way out to the beaches, which allow people with disabilities to walk on, to sit on, to be very comfortable on, and they do not sink in the sand, especially people with disabilities that are in wheelchairs. And I got a new announcement now. Are you ready, Kim?
I'm braced in my chair. What is it?
Okay. As we were laying that mat, I got a call from the big shots in Tallahassee and all, and I got permission, because they're the final people to give me permission to lay these mats. I got permission to lay three more mats in St. Petersburg Beach.
Fantastic. And I should,
Michael,
this is Simon, who's on the line with us, and he knows about this too, the Mobi mats. And one of the things, I don't know, you might have been gone sick when he talked about it, Simon, about the fact that Michael approached the chamber and actually got funding for these mats. So he came up with the idea, wound up pitching it and getting them fully funded, which is a huge accomplishment. It was a great idea.
Yes.
Congratulations. That is incredible.
Well done.
Well, and I think
go on. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, Simon is by the beach on the other side of the coast. You might have to start working on them.
Yes.
Michael is in Florida, and Simon is in California. But, I mean, I've said it before, and I'll say it again, because I've been to the beach on both coasts and even the area that you're talking about, Michael, the Tampa Bay, St. Pete's area. And I can't imagine going to the beautiful ocean and not being able to feel the spray of the beach, you know, having to stay that far away. Now, I'm not like a surfer or anything like that, so I wouldn't be doing that. But just, you know, going along the beach and watching the shells, you know, roll in with the tide and the tide go back and feeling the spray of the ocean, I can't imagine being there and not being able to feel that. And so, you know, for people who would have difficulty walking in the sand, but still enjoying the beach and those aspects of the beach. This is just a godsend to enable people to be able to do that and to plan their vacations around it. If they want to go to the beach, to go to one that they can actually experience and not just look at from the balcony of the condo.
It's wonderful what you do, Michael. Because I know how many times have you done this? I know that you've done them before. How many are you up to now?
This is the fifth one that has been laid, and I'm laying three more on St. Pete Beach, which is in Pinellas County, Florida, and then I going up to Clearwater. There's going to be four more laid.
That's really incredible.
Yeah, I have full funding for more too, which Kim knows that I've been trying to get for so long. Now I have full funding behind me. I just need the town's mayors to give us permission.
It's fantastic.
Because you're making a difference.
I'm going to let you guys go, and you run your regular program. I just wanted to make that announcement for all the
very
all the
proud
people
of you,
listening.
Michael.
Thank you
very proud
much.
Of you, and thank you. Very welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Good night. Bye.
Good night.
That's really quite an endeavor to come up with that idea. And, you know, Michael started with putting ramps, accessible ramps onto houses for many years. And then he got this idea about the Moby mats to bring the beach to people to the beach. And, you know, he started with the first Moby mat. And I don't know if you have this going on in California, but there's a certain time of year, and obviously me being landlocked, I can't tell you what it is, but there's a time that the turtles lay their eggs on the beach, and you can't be laying Moby mats while the turtles are laying their eggs on the beach. So one time when Michael called, he was out pitching, trying to get funding for these Moby mats, but it was turtle season, and they couldn't be physically doing the work then, so he took that time to go out and pitch to try to get funding and more of these mats put down. And now, like I said, being a little familiar with that area, Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater are all in the same proximity. So as far as planning vacation, and I guess we're at that time of year where a lot of people might be planning a vacation, it's a really good thing to know, first of all, that one person can make a difference in this community. A lot of people have, but that is just amazing that Michael came up with the idea and then wasn't afraid. You know, the worst that can happen is someone can tell you no, and that is often nothing personal. You know, it's either funding or somebody's into themselves, got something going on in their life. A lot of times we're afraid to ask because we're afraid of rejection. Coming from a long line of salespeople, myself included, you know, that was the thing that held people back from those kind of successes, is being afraid to ask and taking a no as a personal rejection. And it's not. You know, the answer in there is dial again, dial again, dial again, dial again, and then you get a yes. Statistically, it's just the way the game works. And he did that, you know, except he was much more fortunate. The second place he went, he got full funding for this project, and I think it's just really fantastic. And so thank you, Simon. I know you're happy to let Michael share about that and for everyone
else
to know that that's going on, and they should start working on California now that Disney might be having a little less traffic.
I just want to say, Kim, I was thinking about this before tonight's show because I was writing my notes before airtime, and I made a comment about my notes about the brain injury community, and it did make me stop to think just in that moment about the fact that this show and the audience that you and Craig and your team have put together over the however many years is it, 10, 12 years now, 13 years, it really is a community of people helping other people in quiet, positive ways. And this process that Michael is doing of putting mats on the beach, it helps so many people because, for example, caregivers who are needing to push a wheelchair, it means that they can push that person in a wheelchair. It's really, and it's delicate because it's taking away a very small area of beach away from the people who are able-bodied and can run around on the beach and play like, you know, the kids and everybody. So it's always a balance. And the fact that Michael was able to get funding where a group of society, our group, the brain injury community, and also not also the people who are amputees, who've lost a limb, they get something invaluable. And everybody else, the mayor that Michael's talking about, everybody else says, this is a good accommodation. This isn't a problem for the people who can run around on the beach. And it's a huge benefit because sand, as many listeners know, it's one of the most challenging surfaces there is to walk on. You and I, Kim, never thought about it before we were injured. I never thought about it. I used to like walking around on the beach in Santa Monica. I never thought about the fact of all of the things that have to go on in the mind and in the muscles, the body, for that to be possible. So to restore that, with Michael, to restore that to people in these different beach areas, fantastic.
Yeah, it is, and for those listening, if you know mayors down in other areas down there, there's Sanibel and all kinds of different communities down in that area of Florida. If you know the mayor in one of those areas and you'd be interested in helping Michael, helping your community to be able to get one of these mats, you can find me on Facebook or at inaflash.org, and I'm happy to put you in touch with Michael and make this happen. Like I say, the 8 that he's going to have down are all in a proximity for a very nice vacation. So long as they've got the start there and then anywhere else around the country that there's a beach where we might have listeners. If you're interested, we just would need to know who the mayor is, and I'd be happy to put you in touch with Michael. And now he's broached the topic, you know, more than once, and I'm sure he'd be happy to do it in your area as well. So anyway, very cool thing that Michael's doing, and it's been neat to watch the process from when he first, the idea first germinated, to him doing the first one on his own and then pitching it and getting complete funding and support now in 2 different communities, 2 different mayors. Apparently he's working with city councils and mayors on this. So that's really awesome. So sometimes all you have to do is ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Like I say, the worst you can hear is no. And if you hear yes, you can change life for a lot of people in a very positive way. So don't let fear of rejection keep you from asking. So, Simon, we're going to talk a little bit about blind sight tonight and talk about stress. And I wanted to congratulate you on the article. In that time, I don't know where you found time being bedridden and having procedures that you were able to do another podcast and an article about blind sight, but I found it fascinating when you started telling me a little bit about it. I knew that you had a visual obstruction, our long time also goes back to the very beginning, but he's on twice a month now on Tuesdays. Les Paul, one of our hosts, has about the same kind of field of vision blindness that you do. And it seems an awful lot of people who have had aneurysms and strokes have this condition. So you're kind of out of the box of the people I know that experience this, although I'm sure there are many from many different types of brain injury. But anyway, when you sent me the article and the podcast, I was just fascinated about the term blind sight and the meaning behind it, and thought it would be cool to congratulate you and let you carry some of that over here. Tell us a little bit about how they found you and knew to even ask you about this. I will ask you how it went. I know how it went, folks. And it was a really enlightening article and podcast as well. So the ladies did a great job with the podcast, and Simon did a great job, and I think he has the link. And what I'll probably do is he sent it to me in an email, and I'll post it underneath the show on the Brain Injury Radio Network Facebook page would probably be the easiest way to find it, because there's a lot of people that look on there. Or certainly you can write to me or to Simon, and we'll be happy to provide you with those links. But Simon, so how did you come upon this project in the middle of having your jaw wired shut? No.
Well, my multiple recovery project. Yeah, well, it's been, well,
no,
first of all, to give the recognition to the publication, it's called, just like the state, California Magazine, and it's in association with the California Alumni Association. So I was a student at Berkeley, I think, sadly, such a long time ago. I went to law school at Berkeley, but the California Magazine has been in pub print for about 100 years, I think. And it's part of the outreach for the Alumni Association, so all the alumni receive copies. They also have started, obviously not 100 years ago, but they started this podcast, and the podcast is called The Edge, like the Edge of America, the coast, EDGE, The Edge. And it's episode 16 of that. So if people are wanting to try and find it, and they have, or finding on Kim's website. But it is actually an honest-to-goodness quarterly print magazine, which is awfully nice. I wrote the Alumni Association and, you know, bought a copy for $1.50. Actually, I bought 10 copies. The article is called "I Once Was Blind, But Now?" And so it's The Edge, episode 16, "I Once Was Blind, But Now," or the episode of the current quarterly spring of this year magazine called California. And the host of the podcast and the journalist who interviewed me, then I'll come to how they found me and everything else, is a lady called Leah, L-E-A-H, Worthington. And a little backstory, going back to the time of the crash, before I had any idea that there was Brain Injury Radio Network And I was being told by doctors that, well, actually one doctor, I described it in my book, I don't name him for obvious reasons, and I was desperate for answers. And this was a man, very famous doctor in Southern California, on television and so forth. And I waited in his office, and there's a big book said Harvard Medical School, and it was obviously positioned there so patients who were waiting could be suitably impressed. And he did his test, and at the end of his test, his answer to me was, it's amazing you're alive, be grateful for what you have. No sense of what was possible. So I set up my website and my book website, and when I do interviews or anything, I put it on a tab on my website of interviews so people can access the information. And I put the book website on the hardcover book. It's actually in the inside jacket on the back of the book. And I, again, my publisher said, well, why do you want to do that? And I didn't know. I just thought, well, I don't know, maybe the book will find somebody and somebody will open it up and they'll see the inside flyleaf of inside cover, www.simonlewis.us or riseandshinethebook.com, just like you say, Kim. And on that web page, there's a tab that says interviews. So I do come to the answer ultimately, Kim, as you know. So the answer to how they found me is, I think Leah Worthington was researching to do an article about consciousness. And this brain injury community is not only our listeners, but there are also reporters who write articles about consciousness. And so it's sort of a pool of knowledge of people trying to get answers, because there are so many people. Michael is going to help so many people. And after I've given interviews in the past, I've often received emails. I remember one, Radio Netherlands Worldwide, which is obviously in Holland, and I did it by satellite. It's all very, behind the scenes, it's very modest. My mother drove me to a place in Culver City where they had a hookup, and I did the interview. That interview, the show itself, the government of the Netherlands was cutting budgets, just like everybody does here, and the show was going to go off the air. So, and they made sure that my interview, because they felt what I was saying about consciousness and about my vision was important, they managed to keep the show on, and their last episode of that show on air was the show with my interview. So that interview is preserved because I had a tech person set this up for me. So this is all by way of saying that I tried to, because I knew the stuff always disappears. There's budgets always being cut. So through this process, somehow Leah Worthington, the journalist, searching for consciousness, found the website, found the interviews, felt that I had something worthwhile to say. And because the book has on it the website, and it's possible, because one of the things I did, this has all been about trying to share in my own modest way, when Rise and Shine was published, I donated a copy to the library of where I went to undergraduate in England, Cambridge. And I don't even know why, because I haven't been able to travel since 1994. But I thought, well, I'll send a copy to the University of California, Berkeley Library. So there's a copy in that library. So maybe, because journalists don't save their resources or their sources, but she's sitting in Berkeley writing for California Magazine. So maybe she looked it up because there's a hardcover copy sitting in the University of California, Berkeley. Although you never know, everything gets cut back. You know, maybe they've digitized it, maybe they destroy their copy, their books after a certain number of years. But that's how she found me. And just like Michael, and like you're saying, there is this feeling of David versus Goliath. And it is possible to make a difference, one patient at a time, one Mobi mat at a time. that reaches out to many people. And the amazing thing to me was that when I gave that Radio Netherlands Worldwide interview, a few days later, I got an email, because obviously that person had looked up the book on the internet and found my email. And it was somebody in Australia saying, I was on my way to work in Canberra. He works in the government. He said, what you are saying about consciousness is how I've always seen the world. He said, I had to pull my car over by the side of the road to listen. He said, I've never done that before. I've never written to somebody before that I've heard on the internet. I just want to tell you that what you're describing is how I experience the world. There's something about his eyesight from a head injury. And another time I got a message from somebody in Switzerland, same thing, saying, I live in Zurich. I'm not allowed in Switzerland. I'm a lawyer, something like that. He said, our banker, he said, I'm not allowed in Swiss society. You cannot talk about these issues. It's not socially acceptable. He said, I just wanted to write to you. And then I had a correspondence with him. He said, because what you're saying is how I experience consciousness. So it's very, very satisfying. And Kim, I know that in the chat room, you must see often comments from people. So that's how Leah found me. What happened was because I was, you know, I just today received the from my physical therapist the operative reports, the surgical reports of what the surgeon did on my shoulder to install the hardware in my humerus and my rotator cuff and take it out again. And my therapist's comment was, my Lord, you really are the cat with nine lives. She said, I had no idea. Apparently, the rotator cuff has four major tendons. I ripped two of them, and it was a tremendous amount of work to repair. I don't want to go too far off topic. Oh, heck, why not? That's why I love that you let me do that, Kim. Almost nobody has hardware removed. Simon does. And again, one of the reasons I wrote Rise and Shine was I learned progressively, and I'm not saying this as a conclusion for other people, just my own experience, a hypothesis, that each time I've had hardware removed, I have experienced benefit. And this was a huge job to put the hardware in. The surgeon was fantastic because he was amenable to taking the hardware out. Because I was having issues and pain, he took the hardware out. And I can come back to it, Kim, if you want, but I can talk about the benefits as I experienced them. But now I'm getting the use of my left arm gradually. I've got a lot of work to do to mobilize it. My jaw, in the midst of everything else, readers and listeners will know I have an issue because my jaw is broken in three places in three different ways, as well as my skull and my collarbone and my arms and so forth. So, yeah. But my jaw, the disc in the jaw that enables me to chew, to eat, to smile, to talk, slipped because I put something large, a big olive. And because of all the other things that have been going on, I wasn't paying attention. Anyway, my dentist, he's a specialist in this, without surgery, because you can't do surgery on the jaw, he's able to recapture the disc, which is why I'm back on air, and I can talk and smile. And as my very special lady friend Susanna says, we like the chewy, and we like the crunchy. And I can now, because for 3 weeks, I couldn't let my teeth connect. So I had to keep my jaw open all the time and just eat soft food. So I'm rejoicing on many fronts. I'm delighted about Michael in Florida with what he's doing. But in the midst of this, Kim, Leah reached out to interview me. The first interview was two or three hours. And it started out with blind sight, and it ranged into many aspects of consciousness. There were probably three or four follow-up interviews. Because of my issues that you know, I did ask her, and maybe I shouldn't say this because it's not normally done with interviews, but I asked her if she could tell me the areas, not specific questions, but the areas that she wanted to explore so that I could think about it, because I'm very good, but my recall was one of the things that was damaged. I can remember things very clearly, but it might take me an hour or two. It might take me a day or two or three. It can take a really long time. So, and the other request I made, I'm saying this in case it happens for listeners where they also have the fatigue issue, and it's important whether perhaps it's a job interview, perhaps it's an interview about eligibility for benefits. I asked her, could she make the interview after about 4 p.m. and before 8 p.m. because my day, that's why Brain Injury Radio Network is so helpful for me to do this, because I'm really not good up until about 2, 3, maybe 4 o'clock. By the time we've had lunch, and then for various reasons, there's another issue which isn't really brain injury, but shows the importance of the A of recovery of awareness. We can talk about that. It's so important. I've become aware of a major life-threatening issue, and so that's the importance of remaining aware and looking for issues and addressing them. But because of all of this, I arranged with Leah, and she was very agreeable to it, that I could have the conversations be after 4 p.m. and before dinner time, before 7 p.m. And she would tell me the broad areas so I could think about them. And sometimes I could then reply to her with a long, because I can write, everybody, because of the book, I can write, and I can could gather my thoughts and explain really what I mean. And that led to her with more interviews of 2 hours. It was a lot of interviews. She wrote an extremely long piece, and space on the podcast is very difficult to win because everybody wants to be on that podcast. And she wrote to me. I didn't even know the podcast existed or it was a possibility, because I'm very respectful of the journalist and what they're trying to do. So she wrote to me and said, I don't want to promise anything, but this is so interesting. It came together, and I have such a lot of good material that we're going to try, and my team are going to try and win a spot on the podcast, and they did. And there's music that was composed. So it's really, it's a whole little production. I should say that it's a beautiful production.
Yes.
And there's music that they composed for it. There's little extras. And the article in the magazine, the print article, is about half of the length. When it went to the journal, the editorial side, they ran about half of it, but it includes some of the most current Berkeley research, because this is the Alumni Association of the University of California at Berkeley, and it has a number of interviews with experts researching the issues about vision, what is blind sight. Briefly, I will say that if you listen, and I recommend you do, it's wonderful, Kim, that you're sharing it, because it was missed. Cedars-Sinai is a huge top-of-the-line hospital, and after my intensive care and coma, Glasgow coma scale 3 for a month, and they had just rescued me, the pressure is on to discharge the patient, and it was exceptional. After the month in coma, It was very, that's exceptional as well. But then with a month, just over a month later after that, they discharged me. The rule is everybody now is 1 month and they're out. In my case, it's something like 2 months. The only discovery of my blindness was my brother David, I'll be brief because I may have described this before, coming into my hospital room at Cedars-Sinai, and I was completely unaware that he was there. And that started a process where I went to see a developmental optometrist, Dr. Alan Brodney. And if you listen to the podcast, Dr. Brodney is interviewed. It's really I've listened to it two or three times. It's the kind of podcast, it's podcasting at its very best because it's remarkable information. And it takes, so in my case, I still today listen to it for the third or fourth time, and I'm still learning. It was so interesting to hear the researchers and what they're saying.
Absolutely, absolutely. So give us the example. You were unaware that your brother was there, but how was it determined? You had such vast injuries. I was going to say when you rattled off about 10 things, that was from your shoulders up. Your whole body got riddled with breaks and injuries, and so, you know, you really got it from one end to the other, and so there were a lot of things that they were doing, you know, you were in coma, and they were doing surgery on a lot of things. When I've kind of found that it's the obvious things that get addressed first, what they can see, you know.
Yes.
And then later, kind of incidentally, they find the things they can't, well, no pun intended, see. They can't see.
well said.
As much as, you know, the broken bones and all of that sort of thing. And so at what point was it that they determined, or you determined and let them know that there was a problem with your vision?
It was when my brother David came into the room, and that would have been after I came out of the coma. So this would have been, I was moved, because after when you come out of the coma, then you're moved into a recovery room, and then family are admitted. And so within a few days of that, so I would say 5 to 6 weeks after the hit and run, when my brother came in, it was a subsequent visit. So I had met, they'd come back a few times because my jaw was wired, but I was able to have conversations with my teeth stuck together, of course. And my brother, realizing, because he'd come to see me and was standing in the doorway, and he's a lawyer, and he realized that I was not responding at all. My eyes were open. I was just gazing out, minding my own world in my own sort of dazed state. And he took his hand. He said, "Laddie, tell me, just look straight ahead. Tell me when you see my hand." So I didn't know what he was doing or why. So he did, and I said, "There it is." Well, at that point, his hand was directly in front of my face. And there was nothing. And what Alan Brodney, Dr. Brodney, says, because I'm the first case, and it's 28 years later now, so he told Leah Worthington, because she asked him, I gather, "How many cases of blindsight have you treated?" And apparently he said Simon Lewis was my first, and he said it may be the only case, because, you know, at some point he's going to retire, but he's a wonderful developmental optometrist. And what he did was, when I was discharged from Cedars, once it was established that I was functionally blind, in a field of vision. And a psychologist gave me a test, and this may be familiar with listeners. The test they gave me was to draw a clock face and write the time was, and write the time. And when I drew my clock face, I drew the clock face without a left side, basically. I drew it, and then I wrote the numbers down the right, and then the numbers up the left side of the clock face, kind of a mess. And I don't know that with the clock, they probably said the time is 20 to 8, something like that. And I probably didn't put in the right place, the left-hand side. And then they would have done other tests, such as what time is it showing me a clock? And there was nothing. When my mother first, after discharge from Cedars, took me to see Dr. Brodney, his private report, because then he put me on, and I'm sure this would be familiar. It was less familiar at that time, but now everybody has them, where you look into a machine and look at an illuminated white dot, and you press the button when you see a little flash, and some of the flashes are bright, and some of them are not bright, and some of them are faint. Dr. Brodney, after the first test, quietly told my mother, because I was not as I am now, said there is absolutely nothing in Simon's left fields above and below. There's nothing there. And he said, I don't know whether it will be possible to do anything because there's nothing. He's blind in those two fields. Or functionally blind, I think is the term that is used. That started therapy, and I can talk about the therapists, and they were wonderful, little challenging things with a kaleidoscope and magic eye images to look at, and all designed to try to stimulate visual processes in my brain. And the effect was substantially to restore the lower quadrant. And the upper quadrant remains functionally missing. And towards the end of Alan's treatments, and I described this, and in fact, Dr. Brodney, I came to know him quite well, but Dr. Brodney, towards the end of the treatment, did something, and I describe it in the podcast, where I couldn't understand what he was doing. What he did was he said, Simon, I'm holding up a card. Can you see it? And I was looking, he told me to where to look straight ahead. And so I'm looking straight ahead. I'm very disciplined. And I said, no, that's still in the area that I have no eyesight. I have no vision there. And then he said, what color is the card? And I thought that was a really, really strange question. Bear in mind that I'm a lawyer, because if I can't see something, obviously I have no idea what the color is. My knowledge is zero. So I said, Dr. Brodney, I can't see it. I have no idea what the color is. He said, I know. Just guess. Well, there are an awful lot of colors. An awful lot of colors. It just seemed like a big waste of time because I can't
see
anything.
Wait a minute.
But wait,
I'm sorry. I was assuming maybe a bad assumption. I guess he's not a poker dealer. He's a doctor. I thought you meant like the old card, holding up a card like from playing card, 50-50 chance it would be red or black, but you're talking about a random just card of some kind, index card of some kind that came in many different colors, pastels, primaries, variety.
Yes. It was a piece, presumably, it's something which is part of an optometrist's equipment.
A spectrum.
Or Dr. Brodney specialized in what's called developmental optometry. That was his specialty, specifically developmental optometry, working with children, helping their eyesight to develop, and in some cases like mine, adults with visual impairment. And so I never recommend specific clinicians, of course, because I don't want to be sued or anything. But the field that he practices in is called developmental optometry. And to answer your question, Kim, he was holding up a small, 4x6 or 3x5, that kind of handheld, hand-sized sort of colored piece of paper. I guess not a piece of paper, just a little card. But it was a plain card. I'm glad you clarified. Not a plain card. A little perhaps larger than that, as I say, like a 3x5. And it was, but to answer your question, when he held something up, it might have been a playing card. I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't see it. So he said, I'm holding something up. Can you see it? When I said, no, it's in my blind area, he said, I understand, but what color is it? And I said, I have no idea. I can't see it. And he then said, I know you can't see it, but guess. And to answer your question again, Kim, it could have been any kind of an object. I don't think he told me it was a card. I have no memory of him saying even it was a card. It was just, that's right, because all I knew, I'm thinking back, is he was holding up something, clearly something that he could lift because he was holding it, and it had a color. But I had no knowledge of what it was other than it had a color. And so I guessed orange, but I'm a lawyer. I hate guessing things. I like to work with knowledge and be specific.
No, come Never. On. Was it right? Did you guess?
Yes. Yes. And if you listen to the podcast, and I just want to say, if you listen to the podcast, it is free. And please go to Kim's Inner Flash website. I've given you the names of the articles. I think Sight Unseen, S-I-G-H-T, Sight Unseen would probably find it, or California Magazine, or The Edge episode, whichever episode I said. And it's Sight Unseen, and I once was blind, or something like that. But whatever it was I said earlier. And you'll hear Alan Brodney explain that I kept guessing correctly. And that was when he diagnosed that for the first time in his career, he had a case of blindsight. And in the podcast, you'll hear about how it's been known about since, I think, the 70s, how there was a monkey who they made blind called Lucy. And she was called Lucy, the blind monkey that could see everything. And it's fascinating because the monkey was blind. They had taken away what's called the V1 cortex, which is the main visual cortex. It's grim. I mean, it's cruel to animals. But if it's going to help blind people to see, and it's one monkey who might have died otherwise in the wild and otherwise led a comfortable life, I'm not sure about the ethics myself, but I tell you the story because it wasn't up to me. But what they noticed of Lucy, at first, for about a year, she responded as a blind monkey. And after about a year or 18 months, they were astounded, the scientists, because Lucy started responding. She started reacting to things that the scientists knew Lucy could not see. And the question was, how the heck is that monkey reacting to things that she can't see? Now, there are skeptics who are saying, no, it's something different or it's something else. But again, you can look on the internet to see the person who's functionally blind with a cane walking down a hallway, avoiding objects that he, it's a male patient, that he cannot see. how is he doing that? I have some clues because I wanted to read a little piece of research out, because regular listeners know that Simon Says is never Simon Says unless I come in with a little piece of research.
Yes, please.
And so here goes. First of all, this is a current piece from the University of Queensland Brain Institute, talking about types of neurons in the brain. And it starts out saying how the neurons in the body, down the spinal cord and in our arms and legs, and many of us who have had spinal cord injuries, my spine was broken on both sides, but the spinal cord miraculously was intact, and my spine could heal the bones and the processes. Mind you, at L3, L4, there's almost no cases of people who survive an injury, a fracture of L3, L4. That's the biggest and strongest bone in the body. But those peripheral nerves are fairly straightforward to understand, and they are making incredible advances with how to bridge severed neurons in the spinal cord, because if you can create the right environment, they are finding with animal models, mice and so forth, that you can get the neurons to grow across the gap, which is extraordinary because there's not much understood, but they are, you can distinguish them. But the article then says, whereas in the spinal cord, we can easily distinguish neurons based on their function, that is not the case in the brain. And then it says, there are certainly neurons in the brain involved in sensory processing. For example, the visual. You can at some level say, the scientists can say, those neurons in that brain, they're to do with vision somehow. Or in the auditory cortex, to hearing, you can say, yeah, that's somehow to do with transmitting what's coming in the eardrum, being translated and coming into the auditory cortex. And there are others where the scientists can say, yeah, those neurons are doing work connected with the muscles, the motor processing, taking signals from the brain to the muscles, to the nerve inputs into the muscles where they trigger, cause the muscles to contract. And those are in the cerebellum, which is where the signals go out, or what's called the motor cortex. And oftentimes with stroke patients, there will be some visible damage in the motor cortex, and that's where the damage has occurred and is causing paralysis often. Then the kicker, and that's what leads into blindsight. However, that wonderful word, however, within any of the sensory motor regions, now we're talking about the senses, all of our senses and the motor regions as well, within any of our sensory or motor regions, there are tens or even hundreds of different types of neurons. In fact, researchers are still trying to devise a way to neatly classify the huge variety of neurons that exist in the brain. And I think that is quite magical, because Leah Worthington, in the interview with the leading researcher in Berkeley who's exploring blindsight, at a certain point asks a spiritual question, because brain injury survivors, we as a community, many of us have encountered our own mortality and have survived things that might have killed us, and have confronted things that maybe one day will suddenly kill us. So the question that at one point Leah Worthington asks is whether somehow unraveling this enigma of blindsight will take away the mystery of life. And the researcher gives two answers. One is, no, it won't, basically, because he says every... What's that, Kim?
I think I go with that one, but go ahead. No,
yeah,
I don't think
says,
it will, but go on.
It won't, because every question that they answer, they find five or six more questions. And the other thing is he felt that the mystery of the human spirit will continue even if we have all the answers about how consciousness works, because it still won't explain how originally consciousness evolved, and we'll never know whether it's a divine purpose or not. We'll never know whether there's a divine, because now with the new Webb telescope that's going to look further into the universe than has ever been seen, there are still going to be questions that will never be answered, which is, for example, it's not answerable. There's a theory that dark matter and dark energy are a reflection of what's outside this universe. Is there, for example, a universe outside of ours in which time is running backwards? I mean, these are fabulous. That's, to me, an example of how we won't unravel consciousness and spoil the mysteries, I guess is what I wanted to say there. So that was one of the two articles about the number of different neurons in the brain where researchers aren't yet even sure how to categorize them. And the other item I wanted to read to you is, hold on, let me find it. Yes, this is in January of this year, and it's from a team. This is a very powerful team. A team from the Max Planck Institute of Neurobiology. Max Planck, of course, Planck very much involved with cosmology and issues to do with the universe, but they also have an Institute of Neurobiology. And the University of California, Berkeley, which is a coincidence, but probably it's one of the researchers that Leah Worthington talked to for California Magazine, and Harvard University. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they created a molecular catalog that describes different types of some neurons. So they're starting to make advances in this. And I'll read out the title of the article if you want to look at it on the internet. It's on the internet. It's at neuroscienceNews.com. That's where I found it. The summary, and this is just one sentence, a study supports the theory, still a theory only, study supports the theory that highly specialized neurons in the brain are key to translating diverse visual stimuli into behavior. And the easy way to find it on the internet would be the type of cells they were looking at. And they're called ganglion cells, specifically retinal, to do with the retina of the human eye. Retinal ganglion cells, and those are abbreviated RGC. What are they? The retinal ganglion cells, and blind sight, I believe, is very linked in with the ganglion cells. That's, I think, going to be what they're going to find. These are the bottleneck through which all visual impressions flow from the retina to the brain. And so what they're beginning to think with this molecular catalog, they're beginning to start specifying how they connect, what each one's function is, and how they respond. And a really cute story about the test they're doing, I know it's a bit difficult with the monkey, but they're doing it with zebrafish, these little beautiful zebrafish. And when zebrafish see light, they swim towards it. Yay, it's light. It's party time. But when they see prey, when they see a predator, they escape. That is consciousness. Yeah. That is extraordinary. This tiny little zebrafish it, what it's seeing, and obviously it's seeing it in water, so it's not seeing it like you and I see through the clear air. Obviously, it's an evolutionary response, because the zebrafish that didn't get the message gets eaten, and the zebrafish that gets with the program escapes. So it's a highly, what I call a highly selective behavior. And therefore, through generations, you would very quickly have zebrafish that get the message and swim away from predators. So the point is that it's clear with the zebrafish that the signals are being generated by the photons coming through the water. The photons bombard the retina of the eye, and the neurons in the retina collect and process those in real time, which is astounding. The retina focuses on the important details. I'm quoting from the Max Planck, the Neuroscience News article now. The retina focuses on the important details. Is there contrast? Is it black and white? Are there contrasty things about it? Is there color in the object? Is it small or large? Because we don't want to say too much or impose on the zebrafish assumptions. Could it simply be light is friendly because it doesn't have any kind of solidity to it? And anything that's large might be something that will eat me because it's bigger than me. So are there small or large objects is another thing that the brain sends out to an area to filter out the information that's coming in. Is it something that is moving or static? Well, of course, light can both move and be static. And then once the details are filtered out, these retinal ganglion cells, the RGCs, send the signals to the brain where they are translated into a specific behavior. So they're saying that the RGCs are the only connection between the retina and the brain. But I think that's a little misleading. I don't want to argue or disagree with brilliant scientists at Harvard and Berkeley and Max Planck Neurobiology Institute, but it's a little bit of a fudge, because the RGCs are a collection of these multiple different types of neurons. So they say, to say that the only connections are these RGCs, the connections of these multiple different sorts of RGCs could be astoundingly complex. It might even have to do with which thing sticking out from each neuron connects to a different position on another neuron. We don't know. It's miraculous and beautiful. So Kim, Go ahead.
Well, all I was going to say is, I read a study, I'm trying to find it again, but I can't find it, and this is just really short and sweet as far as the neurons go. It suggested, and the person, a doctor, I can't source it, I'll have to keep looking, but talked about a shortcut. You talked about the visual, the lobe. In the beginning, what's it called? The visual
cortex. The B1.
Yes,
visual
thank
cortex.
You. The visual. Yes. That there's a shortcut. There, this person's studies showed. This was after CAT scans, MRIs, and several thousand people. That there was a shortcut bypassing that area and going straight through the amygdala to the eye, like a shortcut that just bypassed what you're talking about,
which would be interesting. It would be another pathway, and it's what you would expect.
Yes.
Because it would confer a benefit to staying alive, because the speed those humans early on who had the shortcut were probably more likely to survive an attack by a fast predator And those that didn't get that message, didn't stay with that program, got eaten alive. So yes, but this is the wonderful thing about how little is known, how much remains to find out. Maybe I should talk a little bit, because we always like to talk, and that's why I like this show. So one of the many reasons I love the show and love what you do, Kim and Craig, is to talk a little bit about action steps, because I'm a little concerned that there might be people who have blind sight. And obviously I've really suggested a developmental optometrist might be a person to see. Some research into that might be good. And some other action steps. I mentioned the magic eye. I'll come back to that. There are computer-generated images which look normal. And if you develop an ability somehow to look into the image, you see the same image in three-dimensional. It becomes three-dimensional. In the early stages with Dr. Brodny, I couldn't do that. That something about my processing centers of vision in my brain were damaged, and it wasn't there. I looked for ages, nothing. What Dr. Brodny gave me was a funny, you said earlier, Kim, about a pack of cards. It was the size of a pack of cards. I mentioned this in Rise and Shine in the book, because again, I wanted to encourage people to explore and find things that would be not do any harm, but might be helpful. And because I couldn't get the magic eye to be magic, I just remained a circle of dots, basically. Not a circle, but a sheet of dots, fuzzy kind of thing. He gave me cards that were black and white, playing cards, and each playing card had a different optical illusion. And it was very difficult. I would just say, well, I see a flight of steps. And he would say, are the steps going up or down? I would say, just flight of steps going up. And he'd say, well, keep looking. And then he must have given some to me to take home to practice. And as I made progress with all of the other neurodevelopmental things he was giving me in clinic, which were more, he was doing advanced things in clinic with lights and the color wheel and glasses I had to put on that would create a sense of depth. That's right, I'd forgotten that. There'd be Polaroid glasses, and I'd put them on, and then things really looked 3D, triggering that aspect of my brain to see three-dimensionally, because my eyesight, I don't just have blind sight, I see my vision, things look to me as if I'm seeing a memory, not what's really there. I talk about this in the podcast again. So he gave me the equivalent of hitting me over the head with 3D images. So you put on these Polaroid glasses, and it is really foreground and background, major league. So he was able to reawaken that inside my brain, get those. And what's happening is that the neurons are being, the actual circuits in the brain are being stimulated. And what I learned from Dr. Provda, who's in the book, Lois Provda, who I did a long time of cognitive training, her theory, what she did with her students, and again, this is an action step for people who have brain injury at any time in their life, because it used to be thought, after a certain point in your life, you're done with neurons. But we now know that's not the case. The brain is always trying. The problem is that, just like you said, Kim, with the shortcut you described, in order to save energy, because the brain uses a tremendous amount of energy as it is, my hypothesis, by the way, not a conclusion, but my impression and my experience has been that the brain tries to save energy where it can. If there's a shortcut, great, it will use the shortcut. If there's a damage, if there's a trauma that has caused damage to certain things, the brain doesn't go, oh my God, it's not like a cut on your skin where they might be called lymphocytes. I'm not sure. They're the things that create the hemoglobin, the clotting agent. That they actually migrate. It's an astounding thing. Cells in the blood know that the cells in the skin are distressed, and they migrate to that site and start releasing clotting agent. It's astounding. Nobody knows how quite exactly that works. But the brain is not like that. It doesn't stop and send cells to that particular area to heal. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is scar tissue forms. In my case,
yeah,
a small amount of scar tissue saved my life. So I can't say it's in some cases, I'm only alive because of a small flap of scar tissue that forms between the two hemispheres of my brain and preserve that midline. But the brain just works around it because it would take energy to do that repair. That's the bad thing. The magic is that if you do exercises, which is what Dr. Provna's cognitive training was, that's her theory that she was using, and you specifically ask of those neurons to do their work, gradually it is possible to reawaken them. Now, if you have a major brain injury or a bullet travels through your skull, which has happened historically, clearly that the neurons are never going to work around that kind of massive trauma. But about more than a third of the right side of my brain hemisphere is gone, it's scar tissue. So the fact that, and if you look at my TED talk, I showed the effect on my IQ, that was targeted exercises working on specific functions of learning. So coming back to what Dr. Brodny was doing, I was somebody with blind sight who lost a huge amount of vision, none on the left side, upper and lower quadrant. By working this, he was able to reawaken in the lower quadrant, which is the more important quadrant, you could say, because that's why I don't fall over objects, I don't trip over things. It's really a critical one. The upper quadrant is more so that you duck below an overhanging object that's up above the left side of my head. That I would tend not to see, but that's not as common as the object on the ground or the kid or the dog running across below you in front of you. And it started with these cards of optical illusions, and ultimately after the glasses, which made 3D really powerful, at a certain point I was able to get the flight of stairs and I could see that depending on how I looked at it, it could either be a flight of stairs leading up, seen from above the flight of stairs, or looking at a flight of stairs leading down in a basement, looking up at those stairs. And then what he had me do is advance to the point where I could see it one way and then see it the other way and switch it backwards and forwards. And I have to tell you, Kim, it was really, really tiring. That's how I knew Dr. Provna's exercises, which again, I described Rise and Shine and all the rest. I knew that what she was doing in clinic was making some aspect of my brain work really hard, because after about 30 or 40 minutes, I couldn't keep my eyes open. My brain was done. And then she'd let me sit, see another patient, let me just rest for a quarter of an hour because that's the energy it takes. So
absolutely,
go ahead, Kim.
All I was going to say is that's one thing that the scientists can't factor in that they don't know about is the exhaustion it takes for us to process information. they don't know that. You know, they can't experience that in the same way that we do. But that is very interesting. It's all very interesting because I was reading through, and you're right, there's some that think, that have a little bit of a different idea about blind sight, that the vision is impaired, if not a workaround. That was one study I wrote, that shortcut, if you will, and they explained it, like I said, did many studies on it, thought they found proof of this in countless MRIs and CAT scans. Another suggested that, and this had to do with consciousness, that though there's a visual impairment from the way that it was or what you were used to or what we would expect, that there's a memory, a visual memory there that might indicate outlines or like a muted, different level of visual consciousness than what a person knew before, so that it might not be functionally blind. Well, it would be functionally blind when you can't see the way you did before, and you've got a field that you can't seem to see. But one guy's study, now he didn't get as far as the person that was convinced there was a shortcut, that it just bypassed. And we hear that about a lot of different things in brain injury with the neural pathways and so forth, that one thing quits working and it reroutes and is taken up somewhere else in the brain. And that was the one study that I read. And the other just talked about visual memory in the impaired visual field, where you might still see, if not see fuzzy edges, sense them. When you talked about walking down a hall, you might not be able to see the chair in the middle of the hall or the person sitting in a wheelchair in the middle of the hall, but somehow are able to navigate your way down the hall without bumping into those. It was suggested in one of the articles that was a visual memory, where your vision doesn't come in clear like before you had the impairment, but there's a memory that leaves a shadow or a rough edge. Now, I don't know how that would help you know what color something was, but it was interesting because there's time after time that they've done the test that you were talking about, where they asked people to guess who were certain that they couldn't see, and yet they could. They were guessing correctly the color. I read a couple different pieces on that, and same thing that you were talking about. A person could guess the color even though they swore they couldn't see it. So on some level of consciousness, there was some visual memory or ability to be able to process something you don't think you can see. But it's interesting because in where you left it with the question that they posed, the yes or no, I think no, and for the reason that you said, because whenever one question is answered, you know, as you said, another five questions pop up, and it seems that there's always been kind of a hard rub between science and spirituality, and you even talked about it in terms of being a lawyer. You know, you flatly said if it couldn't be proven, if you couldn't see it, how on earth could you know what color it was? There was no flexibility there. You know, that was that was black and white, cut and dry thinking.
Yes.
You know, there, and that's I couldn't help but think that might predetermine something. But what, you know, what your doctor did was showed you something else outside the box that you were used to operating in, that rather proved that there was more to it than that, like the near-death experiences do. You know, there's a lot of people that don't believe in that, yet there's a lot of us that have experienced them and know them to be as real as the sun coming up in the morning. Yet,
yes.
Thunder. I hear thunder. Yet people will still argue that point. So that's why I think the answer is no. There's always going to be disagreement, and there's always been disagreement between science and spirituality. Whenever science tries to prove something spiritual, something interrupts, and it doesn't seem to work that way. But it's a very fascinating topic, and I don't think anyone's talked about it before. There's, again, it was at the beginning of the show in the first, probably at 20 minutes, and I'll say to you guys, because I've been telling my host, my other hosts, that people, when you have a link to the show, the live link after the show concludes becomes the on-demand link. It's the same link. And when you click on it, there's a slider underneath the scrolling pictures with the time on it. The shows are 120 minutes, and the slider will show you the time. So, for example, let's say some people on the East Coast go to bed, they've listened to an hour of the show, they really want to listen, but they nod off because it's an hour later, you know, there for them. And you're on the, you know, you're on the Pacific Coast, so it's a little different for you even, you know, but for me it's 10:27 now, so it's, you know, almost 11:30 for people on the East Coast. What you can do, you don't have to listen to a whole show again, folks. If you know that you fell asleep about an hour into it, just click on the link again. You can always find it at braininjuryradio.com in the on-demand section, or on my own website in aflash.org under the shows tab, or just my shows. Brain Injury Radio has, we're on 7 nights a week and have about 20 different hosts. So it depends on how much looking you want to do. If you're looking for a certain kind of content, by all means, go to braininjuryradio.com. If you're looking for something out of a show, one of my shows, it's a shortcut to go to inaflash.org and look. But anyway, you can take the slider and drag it. If you know you fell asleep at 60 minutes, just drag the slider to 60 minutes and it'll start there. Simon gave the information about the article, the publication, the podcast, and that was about 20 minutes into the show. So I'll capture what I can of it, but you can also just click the link, the slider, and put it right at about 20 minutes. Michael came on at the very beginning for maybe 15 minutes, and then the first question I asked was about the article and the show. So by all means, oh, good. Someone in the chat room said they did the slider thing, and it was a great tip. And it only took me 12 years to tell you all this, that you don't have to.
I had no idea,
re-listen.
Kim. I had no idea, and I was just going to tell you, I think it's fantastic. Well, really, it's amazing what Brain Injury Radio does, what you guys do.
Well, and I tell you, it took 12 years to mention it, but people have probably been thinking that you know, if they miss something, that's why one thing I repeat all the time, and I didn't have these links at the time that I scheduled the show to put in the show. But one of the things that I say all the time at the inside of my shows, if I'm interviewing a guest and well, I said it about your book, but if they have a book or a documentary or a nonprofit or whatever, I always put the website inside my program notes. So I tell people they don't have to go back and listen to the show over again if they're in the car or in their lounge chair or whatever and they're not by a pencil. Don't worry about it. You know, whatever website I say on the air is in the program notes, so all you have to do is go click on the link where the show description is and the website will be in the program notes. Well, you know, like I said, 12 years later, the other thing is, I guess I've never said, and I guess I noticed it pretty early on, but I didn't think to mention it, I guess, is just that slider. You don't have to listen to an entire show again. If there was something that you were really interested in, but you fell asleep, you know, especially you're on the East Coast, maybe you're on medication, you're on any coast, you know, we all have different things come up, or the doorbell rang, or an important long-distance phone call came in, you can pick up the show where you left off by just dragging the slider, and you don't have to hear the whole thing again. That's just a tip. But anyway, Blindsight is a super interesting topic, and it looks like there are quite a few places, well, I can't say quite a few, but there's at least five or six that I looked at that are studying this, wanting to know more about the phenomena of blindsight, and I hadn't even thought of that. I don't know that we've ever had that as a topic before, any of those, in all of this time we've been on the air. So it was a great thing to touch on. By all means, listen to the podcast, read the article, Google blindsight, and this same, in fact, the article, I think, comes up because the hand deal that you were talking about and a couple of the different things that you were talking about were noted in these articles. The BBC has one on there too. Your homies at the BBC
have an article. From my past.
Mm-hmm. Past homies. You're just trying to distance yourself from the party boy with the must hair right now.
Yes. Oh dear. Well, I have to say there's something very English about a scandal which involves people having a cocktail in the back part in the back garden. It's there's something
well,
wrong.
Well, our people
anyway, I won't go political, but I do find there's something kind of modest about the scale of the both the scandal and apparently I think the fine was quite modest. They'll always be in England. I'm very glad I'm in California and in America.
Where your governor did the same thing.
That wasn't unique,
you know. I was kind of laughing as they were dissing poor Mr. Hare there. Sorry, I can't think of his name. But
Boris,
right?
Was it Kim Johnson? Boris Johnson.
Yep, Boris. But there were countless people here, politicians here, that did the same thing. You know, the California governor was one of the first that got busted for it. Just about everybody who was volleying for mandates and passports got caught at a garden party. So that, you know, Boris wasn't unique in his sin, you know, of having a couple of parties during a time. It's just the ironic part of it was, you know, we're all going around with like chickens with our head cut off, not knowing what's true, and we can ask five people and hear five different things, and the people that were pushing the hardest, California politicians, other politicians now around our country, and then in England, it does kind of one of those things that makes you go, you know, when it's the people pushing the hardest that wind up getting busted doing that kind of thing. There's people we would expect to do it, like the spring, not spring training, the people who get out for college,
break.
Spring.
Yes,
you'd expect them to do it, but not the politicians, you know, that are, you know, making you, you know, have a phone passport and a blood test and a three layers of mask to get into a movie theater. You know, you wouldn't expect them to be guilty of doing what they tell others not to. But anyway, that's politics. We only have 23 minutes. I don't even know that we can do this that quick, but there's only 10 of them. Anybody, if you're in the chat room, if you're in the chat room and you have a writing utensil, we can do something real quick. Simon, do you have a writing utensil or a typing utensil?
I do.
Here.
Writing.
Okay. Listeners, what we're going to do just really quick-like, and then we'll leave you to ponder this, is the perceived stress scale. Now, this is Psych 101, goes back to 1983, and this is a classic stress assessment instrument, and this tool is still unbelievably, when I read it, one of the most, I don't know that I want to say popular, most frequently used instruments to help professionals gauge your stress level. And you can just simply Google stress scale, and you'll come up with the PSS, perceived stress scale. But there's 10 items. And when I read them, you're supposed to not think about this. Just, this is one of those things. Put down your first response. But I guess one thing you might want to write down, there's going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. 0 being never, 1 being almost never, 2 being sometimes, 3 being fairly often, and 4 being very often. So did you get that? 4 very often, 3 fairly often, 2 sometimes, 1 almost never, 0 easy, never. And what you're going to do is put one of those numbers in front of these 10 statements I'm going to read you. And it says, don't put a lot of thought to it. Put down your first response. So, for example, number 1, in the last month, how often have you been upset because of something that happened unexpectedly? And put in 0 through 4, one of those numbers. Never, almost never, sometimes, fairly often, or very often. I'll go on to number 2. In the last month, how often have you felt that you were unable to control the important things in your life? Number 3. In the last month, how often have you felt nervous or stressed? Number 4, in the last month, how often have you felt confident about your ability to handle your personal problems? Number 5, in the last month, how often have you felt that things were going your way? I was going to be guilty of thinking too much about that. Number six, in the last month, how often have you found that you could not cope with all the things you had to do? Oh, shit. Number seven, in the last month, how often have you been able to control irritations in your life? Number eight, in the last month, how often have you felt that you were on top of things? Number nine, in the last month, how often have you been angered because of things that happened that were outside of your control? And number 10, in the last month, how often have you felt difficulties were piling up so high that you could never overcome them? Okay, now that seemed straightforward and that's the end of it, but I don't understand the scoring. It's going to tell you to do a couple things. It says, to determine your score, follow these directions. First, reverse your scores for questions 4, 5, 7, and 8. On these four questions, change the scores like this. For example, let's go to question 4 on your page. And you want to do the opposite number than what you put there. For example, if you would have put 0 on question 4, you want to put 4. Do you see what I'm saying on this? If you put 1, you want to put 3. You're actually flipping the number from what you put there to the opposite.
Now, Kim, what would be... Oh, I see. Okay, so 3 fairly often would be... Would the opposite of that be almost... What would be the opposite of 3, for example?
3 is fairly often, so it'd probably be 1, almost never.
I see.
So, have you got the first one switched on question 4?
Yes.
Question 5 is the next one. Now, I'm going to need to do that, too. So, and we got to do it quick. We got about 17 minutes. I guess I didn't need to do this tonight. But 4, my question 4 is this, so I'm going to be putting the opposite will be this. Then on question 5, oh, mine's the same, so I'm going to be putting that. If you need any help on those deals again, tell me. Do you feel clear on 4 and 5?
I'm just wondering what the opposite of sometimes is.
Well, it says 2 equals 2. You get to leave that one the same, I guess. It says 2 equals 2.
Okay. So 4, that's right. I said so 4, 5, so 7 is the next one that has to be switched. Okay.
Yeah. God, and it's funny because I have the same one on each one. Mine's real easy. 7 and 8. And so
okay,
on
I've done
eight,
4, 5, 7, and 8.
Okay, now what we do is we add those up with our new numbers. So add up those 10 numbers to come up with a total. Okay, you got a total?
I think so. Just double-checking. Okay.
Okay, great. That was fairly quick. So, now, you put your total score. Individual scores can range from 0 to 40, with higher scores indicating You've lost it. Higher perceived stress. So, here you go. Scores ranging from 0 to 13 would be considered low stress. Are you that low?
No.
Mine
no,
was,
no.
Let's just I'll say. Even tell. Mine was 23.
Mine was 28, Kim.
Okay, you're one into. All right. You, and that was, you know, I did go ahead and do what they said, but that one that I was hedging on would have put me right there into your range. But anyway, scores ranging from 14 to 26 would be considered moderate stress, and I'm not surprised. Scores ranging from 27 to 40 would be considered high perceived stress. The perceived stress scale is interesting and important because your perception of what is happening in your life is most important. Consider the idea that two individuals could have the exact same events and experiences in their lives for the past month. Depending on their perception, total score could put one of those individuals in a low stress category, and the total score could put the second person in a high stress category. So if you did this exercise with us, oh, Ron did it too, and he's a 27. So you guys are both in the high perceived stress category. And unbelievably, I'm in moderate. I'll have to go back and check those numbers I flipped. But it does say the last month. Yeah. Well, it says the last month, and there are some things that I came to accept. I felt a lot differently. You know, back a couple of months ago, as my dog was dying and as we were hearing about, you know, that next vaccine to come out, you know, so COVID was on the brain, I would have been right there with you guys in, you know, in, anyway, I've had a month. I've had a month now to process the one loss and the decision I made, you know, and again, it's not really a discussion. This is just a comment about getting that second booster is I decided not to. You know, my cousin lives maybe, she moved, that's right. How far is Bakersfield from you? Horrible place compared to where she lived before.
Well, Bakersfield is a fair way. It's not huge distance. It's north. It's up north from here, from LA.
Yeah, she used to live in your area. I'm trying to think of where. She was a victim of a serial killer in your area back in the 80s, and that's where she lived most of the time. But her daughter became the school superintendent in Bakersfield, and when her husband died, she moved to where her daughter was. And why did I say that?
Stress, something to do with stress.
Mm-hmm.
Measuring stress.
Her doctor, I wrote my doctor about should I get that second booster, and he just wrote back and said yes. I'm very dissatisfied with my doctor, not because of that. The doctor I had for a lot of years retired, and there's a young pup that's come in, and it is so far from Dr. Welby. You know, my other doctor, I only called him a couple times, you know, in the evening, or called whatever doctor was on, you know, answering the phones or whatever. And it happened to be my doctor, my old doctor back in the day. And he would, like, answer your question and talk to you for a few minutes. No, you weren't on the phone chatting with them at 7 in the evening for an hour, but, you know, asking them about it. And you know, this guy has rubbed me wrong. My new little doctor, who looks about 12, has rubbed me wrong a number a number of times, and I'd like to find a new one. But in any case, my cousin Jenny's doctor, Jenny lives in Bakersfield, but she goes, her doctors are in the LA area, probably at your whatever the hospital is. But anyway, he sent out a note to his patients, and of course he was covering himself. He wasn't going to say a yes you should get it or no you shouldn't get it, but he gave the pros and cons for your consideration because everybody's got questions. And I thought, how opposite my doctor that this doctor would communicate with his patients by sending out a letter and just addressing a concern that was on everyone's mind. You know, all we heard for 2 years, 24/7, you know, was about COVID. And then election year rolled around, nothing. It was like nothing. We never hear about it again, you know. Yet these vaccines keep getting churned out, you know, and they throw that in, and now they're having a commercial every 10 minutes for what I feel is a controversial COVID pill that came out by Pfizer. Read the emergency use authorization yourself and see what you think I have. But in any case, what he said is that that vaccine, that booster, pardon me, lasts about 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. Now, I know, and they were already talking about another one coming out in fall. Now, you know, I was on the fence from the very beginning about this, but I got the two Pfizer shots. I got the booster shot. That's probably down to not very much right now, but, you know, after I read her doctor's thoughtful note, reasons why and other considerations, and then left it up to you, but put enough information out there on both sides for you to make it, to make you feel like you were being listened to, for one thing, which I thought was most impressive in the healthcare field today. Jenny shared the letter with me so that I could read it, and it was on that basis that I made the decision to not bother with the second booster, and I'll listen and probably get the one in the fall. And in the meantime, I'm going to continue to practice protocols. I am going to not be locked in my house. It's summer. I'll be outside. I'm probably not going to be wearing a mask outside, but you know that Gary and I are going out of town on our road trip, and where we stay, it's an individual unit, the castle, so it's not a hotel where there's people in coming and going. We talk to them about the, you know, usually a cleaning lady comes in every day and changes the sheets and changes the towels and whatever. We asked about that, and they said that you could put all your towels in a bag, hang it on the doorknob, and that they'll leave you fresh towels, and that if you need any soap or anything else you might need, to let them know, and they'll leave it in a bag. So for that week, nobody has to come in our unit, and it's been completely sterilized ahead of time. And, you know, the other thing is that there'll be one day, they've got a really cool shopping area, very artsy kind of place, but most of what we do at this place anyway is outdoors. And frankly, I need the time away, even if we stayed on the back deck that looks out into the woods and watch the squirrels jump from tree to tree and the deers wander below in the forest and the birds land on the branches coming down, or in the big heart-shaped hot tub upstairs. You know, if we never left, I'd be happy. But I also called ahead, and they also have curbside or delivery everywhere, which is no different than what we're doing here. The majority of what we do is outside. The one day that I go to the really cute little shops downtown. I've been there enough times now that I know the ones that I like, and I will wear masks into them. And if they're crowded, if I poke my head in and they're crowded, I'll circle back to that one when it's less so. And I've got I bought a bunch of sanitizers. In fact, one different thing going on this little road trip than any other road trip I've gone on is I've got a tote bag, and it's got Clorox wipes, Lysol spray, enough little hand sanitizers to last 6 months, and it's only going to be a week. So no reason to have to go to a store, even a sanitizer for clothing, you know, that you can spray on it, because we're not going to have a washer and dryer.
Wow.
But they actually make that, believe it or not. So if you're ever looking for something like that, if you're one of those people that change your clothes every time you're out somewhere public, which I did a lot, especially like if I had to go to a doctor's office or something, I didn't come home and wear those clothes the rest of the night. I didn't take them off in my garage either, but I came in and threw them in my hamper or my washer and put on clean clothes. I just felt better that doing that. But anyway, we're going to take all the precautions that we take here. But anyway, I guess the only reason my stress went from moderate, I was going to say from the heavy duty stress level, as I've had time to process, am I any happier about losing Benny? No. You know, do I still have my moments? Yes. But do I believe with all of the years he gave me of love, unconditional love and happiness and joy, would I want to see him suffer one more day? Do I have any second guessing about the way things happen? No, I don't. I believe that my other dogs that went before him were there to meet him, and that he's happy and healthy again. I miss the hell out of him, you know, but I believe he's fine, which is most important to me. And it'll be really nice to get away. You know, that's something to look forward to. And for a long time, a lot of us didn't have a lot to look forward to because it seemed like we were in the never-ending pandemic and scared to do anything, you know. And so I know for the bulk of the last 2 years, between my parents, some procedures I had to have, the dog getting sick and dying, you know, there were so many things that for the last 2 years, I would have probably been pressing 40 on this stress scale. And it did say in the last 30 days, you know, and in the last 30 days, I've had something to look forward to. I've had time to process some information. And Jenny's letter from her doctor, her sharing that actually made me feel at peace. It's the not knowing that drives me crazy. And it's not like I'm going to second guess this decision either. You know, I made a decision and that's it, you know, because there's people that are getting these vaccines that are still getting COVID. So I'm not recommending that you don't. I'm just simply complimenting a doctor that was kind enough to send out a letter to his patients and how impressed I am that he did that. And again, he covered himself. He didn't recommend that you do or that you don't. He just gave some fact to help each person decide what was best for them. And for the amount of time I stay home, and I will be again when I get back, except for doing things outdoors, I just felt that I could forego this one and pick up the one in the fall, and that made me feel better. But anyway, we're coming down to the last 30 seconds. For those of you who ranked high in your stress levels, I'm hoping that over the next month, if we did this test again quickly next month, that maybe those numbers would be lower because there would be some resolution coming. You know, whether that's just in the way that you process information, perhaps doing some relaxation techniques, whatever it might be that makes you feel better and puts your heart more at ease. I'm hoping that that will come over the next 30 days, and maybe I'll pull that out of the trash. I just threw it in the trash. No, maybe I'll pull that out, and next month we'll try it again and see. You know, both of the chat room scores and yours were within 4 points of being at moderate. And so that would be a big tell a month from now to do it again and see if your scores were in the same place, in a worse place, or in a better place. Because
nice
we
idea.
All know, and we are, sorry at the end of the show, but I will say the reason why that's important to compare it is because, you know, like I said, had I taken this 2 years ago, I know that I've lived at a super high level of stress for a couple of years, and that makes you sick. It makes you sick physically. It makes you sick emotionally. It makes you sick spiritually. It makes every symptom that you have, from chronic pain to neuro fatigue to sensory overload, it makes everything worse. And that's kind of what I've been living for the last couple of years. But, you know, in the last 30 days, I've just been able to process through a few things and not had more dumped on the bucket and have something to look forward to getting away, something that feels a little more like normal. And so next month, let's see, I pulled that out again, and we'll take just 10 minutes to run through it next month for anybody that's here when Simon comes back on the last Wednesday. Oh, no, you won't
Kim,
be here, will
Kim,
you, next
yeah,
month?
No, I won't be. I'll be having high stress.
Oh, that's right. So your score would be higher. I'll wait then, and maybe it'll be 60 days from now when we go through this,
yeah.
And that gives
yeah.
gets us through spring into summer to go through the test again. But we want to wish Simon good luck for the last Wednesday in May. He'll be going through surgery again. So,
it's tests. I'm going through very heavy-duty tests to check, a follow-up test.
Okay, that's right, a test. I'm sorry, I'm watching this lightning and hearing this thunder outside now. I'm sitting by the back porch thing, and I've got the door open and the screen, so I'm watching this like flash bulbs going on and the rumble of thunder beyond out there. So I think I'll grab my Libby and Tino and take them out because the thunder's far enough away. I know it's going to rain like hell in about 15 minutes. So in any case, Simon, it was so good to have you back this month.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're back. I'm glad that you're holding steady for the time being, and wish you luck on your tests at the end of the month. And Ron left in the chat, thank you for being here tonight, and good night, and God bless to everybody before you guys start hearing the thunder. So I'm trying to find him. Where is he? Well, I lost him. Okay, this is Craig, the founder of our network. I'm going to play out. This is called For Me, and thanks so much for being here, everybody. Good night. God bless. Have a great week, month. And I'll see you next week. Dr. Robert Fraser is going to be my guest. And then Karen will be with me the following week. So thank you, Simon. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Kim.
Good night.
crash into the middle of nothing to me. Forgotten on my own while I'm waiting for someone, you see. Makes me sad. Oh, 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 oh. Faster than